Coming up on today's show.
When I got done, Doug Morris said to me, he said, "You ever get nervous when you sing?" And I said, "Every once in a while I do, you know." And he said, "Well, you just sang to all the biggest names in the music business. You should never be nervous again." And you know what? I haven't been.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Stick around, though, as I have a brand new option for interaction with this show that I'm going to be telling you about in a little bit. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line, from just north of Charlotte, North Carolina, my guest is a recording artist who has toured the world, sold hundreds of thousands of records, and written songs recorded by superstars. Just under 2 weeks ago, he released a new album, and the same day, a new documentary premiered on Amazon Prime, exploring his life story. His top two songs on Spotify alone have a combined total of over 859,000 streams, and he has shows coming up in Central Florida and in North Carolina. He has performed on Good Morning America, Fox News, CMT, and more than a dozen appearances on the Grand Ole Opry. He had risen to fame with his debut single, Lipstick, which dominated the Billboard Country Singles chart for 10 weeks. You've been hearing a song of his called Where I Belong? Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Rocky Lynn.
Good afternoon, Bruce. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Hello, everybody.
Absolutely, Rocky. I'm looking forward to this. Thank you for making time to talk with me today. Let's get started by having you share with the audience all about the song of yours that was just playing called Where I Belong, especially since I was talking over it and they couldn't hear the lyrics.
Well, the song Where I Belong, I wrote with my friend Daryl Burgess, who's just a great songwriter from Canada. And it's about trying to find where you're supposed to be, whether through the good things or bad things or all the troubles and trials and tribulations that you go through in your life, and you end up on the other side. You know, what's funny is it kind of looks like we planned it, doesn't it? You know, after all these years, it looks like we planned it and this was all meant to be. But Actually, it was probably a lot of happenstance that got us here. And that's kind of what that song's about.
Okay. Is your catalog typically done in co-writes, or is there kind of a percentage breakdown of, you know, I maybe write a quarter of them myself?
I think most of them are solo writes. I've been writing pretty much every day for decades and decades. And then when I had my record deal on Universal, I started doing a good bit of co-writing, and I came up with a group of guys. There's about five or six of us that I really love, and I try to get as much as I can to sit down with those guys and write. So I have a small group of people that I co-write with, and I enjoy co-writing, but I think that the more truthful things usually come when you're writing by yourself.
Wow. And audience, that song, Where I Belong, is off of Rocky's brand new album, which is titled Love. Congratulations on that release, Rocky, and tell us all about it, who you worked with on it, meaning producer-wise. Where was it recorded? Over what period of time were those songs written? All the details.
Well, the album, Love, goes along with our documentary movie, and we recorded it at my studio here in Statesville, North Carolina. It's called Tone Studios, and I produced it, and I mixed it, and engineered it myself.
Wow.
But it's a different process, Bruce, than we normally did. Up until this record, I would write, figure out what songs we might want to put on there, and then I would write a national number chart for it, and then I would do a little demo. And on the demo, I would play, you know, if I felt like it needed drums, I would try to play some drums on it, or piano or guitar or whatever. And then my band would come in, or a session guys if we were doing that, and I would play with them, and they would kind of make my demo better. That's kind of how we went in the past. But this time, we wanted it to kind of focus on our live show, because our live shows, we get so many compliments about the band jamming and just kind of being very liquid in the way the arrangements move in and out of each other. So the way this album worked is I would have the song written, and then the guys would come in, guys and gal. We have a young lady in the band as well. And we'd eat dinner, and then I would just play them the song. I would just sit on the couch and say, here's how it goes. And we'd go through the song in the little living room area there with everybody on acoustic instruments and the drummer kind of banging away at the table until we had it. And that could take, you know, it could take an hour or 2 hours. It could take a while. And when we felt like we were playing it with no charts, no nothing, just sort of we were getting it under our hands, then we would go back into the studio and cut it. And I think that contributed to us getting a really live feel on the album, because essentially it is live.
Yeah, yeah. And what I love about that story is just last week, Jim Wilson was talking about the fact that he feels that there is starting to be a little bit more of a trend towards going back to bringing everybody together to record all at once instead of, oh, the guitar player came in last week and tomorrow the drummer is going to come in and then the next day we're going to have the bass player do his parts. So I love that you did this not only band approach, but like you said, virtually a kind of electronic business card of this is what you're going to get almost when you go see us live.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Bruce, because I think that is what happens. And in the movie, other than when we show the Universal videos of Lipstick and Do We Steal, all the other music in there is live. It's not canned music, and we're not pantomiming to it. It's all live, played as it is music. And I'm very proud that we did that, you know. And then on the record, it's the same way. We just played it in the studio there till we felt like we had the right take. And that take is what you hear.
But are you someone, Rocky, and again, I got to give credit where credit is due. This goes back to my conversation with Jim Wilson last week. Are you someone that availed yourself to, hey, what did you just do right there? I liked that. Play that again. That's not the way I had it written, but that little groove that you just did or something improv that happened, do you avail yourself to that creativity of the other musicians in the room? Or is it, you know, I'm pretty set in my ways. I got my Nashville numbering. These folks have the charts and I really try to just get them to play what I wrote.
You know, ever since I started playing in bands, Bruce, my only real criteria wasn't even really the style of music. I want to learn how to play jazz and rock and country. I want to play all the styles. But the main thing I wanted was I wanted to be in a band where everybody in the band was better than me. So I could learn off of them, so I could thrive off that. So not only do I welcome those recommendations by these men and young lady that I play with, I want that camaraderie between us. And we would sit and talk about it. And it's interesting because when I write a song, it's kind of like, you know, my songs might be 3 minutes long or 4 minutes long, but they stay in that sort of vein. But when you get drummers and bass players involved in arrangements, some of these arrangements, you know, went on, there's a song on there, Love You Now, that's like 7 minutes long on the record. Wow. And that was a lot to do with the guy saying, what if we had this bridge that went this way? So we would cut it. And then there was a couple of songs that even after we had cut it, and we started playing that live, we went back and recut it because we came up with an arrangement twist.
Wow.
That was better.
Wow. And so now let's circle back to the start, Where I Belong. How did that song finish up compared to the way it was originally written? Was there much changes? Was there much improv on that one?
There's a ton of it. And at the end of it, at the end of that song, we were talking about, I just watched this documentary about Peter Green, who was, you know, a massively wonderful guitar player and a big part of the early Pink Floyd years. And we were talking about David Gilmour and that. And at the end, that jam that goes on at the end of the song that kind of just goes on forever, we were kind of thinking like Pink Floyd and the light shows and how we would work that all together. So I think that whole segment at the end is very much a band collaborative effort.
Fascinating. Wow. Wow. Okay. I want to hold off on asking you about the documentary that came out the same day as your album, because I think it's going to help the audience if they hear about your backstory first. You have a story that I honestly do not think in 533 episodes over 10 plus years of this show we have ever heard. Tell the audience what I'm referring to as far as a, in my opinion, life-changing event when you were just a baby.
When I was just a baby, Bruce, I was abandoned and left at the doorstep of a place in Troutman, North Carolina, called the Berrien Springs Home for Children. And that's where I spent the first part of my life. And, you know, it gives you a lot of things as you grow that you try to, because you never, I never really knew where I was from. And then as a young boy, when I was 5 years old, I was adopted by a wonderful man and lady here in Statesville.
So does that mean that you were in that facility where you got dropped off? You were there for 5 years?
I was there and in a couple foster homes as well for 5 years.
Wow. Well, I want to try to go in the right order here so that there are no spoilers. Let's fast forward to something you're really passionate about. And then my next question will end up drawing upon this. But you not only served our country, but also co-founded a charity organization that serves the military community.
When I was in high school, I wanted to go to this school in California called GIT. It was a big guitar school. And my arrangements, you know, financially were pretty poor, and I didn't have a lot of options. So for me, the option was to go to work at the furniture factory in the little town of Statesville where I lived, or to join the Army. And if I joined the Army, they would pay for me to go to that school in California.
Wow.
So the day after high school, I went into the Army, and the Army, Bruce, gave me so much more than I ever could have given the Army. It was shortly after Vietnam. It was 1983. And all of the senior non-commissioned officers, the people who were the drill sergeants and the airborne school teachers and those people, they were all Vietnam guys. And they had seen things that and done things, you know, that people shouldn't have to do. But they were tough guys, and they pointed. I wasn't a kid that was a bad kid. I mean, I wasn't in trouble or anything like that. I just didn't have any direction. Mm-hmm. And those men pointed me in the right direction. You know, get up every day and do your homework and make your bed and do whatever your job is to the best of your ability. And now I sit here as a grown man with a family and children that are doing well in this world. And I have those men to thank for that. And fortunately, I was deployed while I was in the military and saw the other side of what being in the Army is like. And so that's why I started my charity. I started it 21 years ago, and it's called Tribute to the Troops. And what we do is get on motorcycles, and we go to the very home that these young men and women who have died in Afghanistan and Iraq since 9/11, where they grew up, and we stand in their parents' yard, and we tell them that we remember.
Wow.
Because I had a mother say to me one time, a Gold Star mother. Gold Star means a mother who lost her kid. She said, it feels like you die really 2 days, the day that you actually perish and the day that nobody cares. And what Tribute tries to do is to say that we care, because there's something about going where the young man or the young woman grew up, and you see their house and their yard, and you realize that every single day is Memorial Day at their home. They don't get away from it. And oftentimes, Tribute is coming to see them 10 or 12 years after it's happened. And even if it was a KIA, there's a lot of fanfare, but then it dies down. And one of the things that Tribute has really focused on over the years is visiting people who lose their battle with post-traumatic stress and take their own lives because they don't get any support. And then sometimes there's a feeling of like they did something wrong or whatever, but truly, we treat those people just like the same people that get killed in battle when they were serving our country. And we've been able to help 123 children go to college over the last 21 years. So I'm super proud of that, too, man. I tell you, for a kid that grew up in an orphanage in North Carolina, that's more than I ever thought I'd be able to do. And I'm so proud to be a part of it. Thank you for asking about it, Bruce.
Yeah, bravo, bravo. I'm emotional. I've got a cry in my throat. I've got goosebumps on my arms. It's, oh my gosh, fantastic, fantastic work. I know, audience, this isn't what you expected to show up for. And, you know, we're going to talk lots and lots of music. But such important work that Rocky and his charity organization are doing. Just tremendous. It's so, so good to hear that story, Rocky. Thank you. Actually, before I ask that next question that I had started to allude to, let's have a teaching moment here. For any up-and-comers who are listening, because they try to get tips to help their music career, they're going to hear about the work you're doing through Tribute to the Troops, and the temptation is to solely focus on, how does that help Rocky's music career? Does it get him more fans? Does it help him get more downloads? Does it help him get more subscribers to his YouTube channel? Are those fair questions, Rocky, for a young artist to ask? Or is it, man, if that's your attitude going into an initiative like Tribute to the Troops, you're missing the real opportunity, the real message?
I think you're right on the latter part of your thought there, Bruce. I think that if you do something like that, you should just do it for the sake of love, of support and recognition of those men and those women that served our country, or whatever charity you happen to pick for. It's interesting. I have an album called Songs for Soldiers. And the reason I wrote that entire album was because in 2005, they asked if I wanted to go over there to Afghanistan and Iraq at Christmas time and sing. And I did. I absolutely said, yes, I want to do that. And that year, I was lucky enough to have Lipstick out, which was a hit, you know, and I had a song that was on the Oak Ridge Boys' Greatest Hits record, and I had written Arrows at Airplanes with Steve Warner, which was a single as well. But the last thing that I wanted to do, Bruce, was go over there and say, hey, look at me, here's my big fancy song, because there again, it's those men that had done that for me. So I decided to write songs about them, about being deployed and being in the military. And usually, you know, patriotic songs oftentimes are slow and maybe sad, but these were the opposite. I wrote up-tempo songs with titles like I'm Proud to Be a Soldier and Heroes Come from Small Towns and Ain't America Beautiful. And then when I went over there the first time in 2005, that's what we sung. And my thought was, I would go over there, I'd recorded them and made a CD of them, and then every young man or woman that we played for, I would give them a CD.
Wow.
And that was supposed to be it. I mean, I just thought, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to come back and do my career or my charity or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, but when we got back, those men and women had sent that music everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
Like in the office, we had people saying, I would like to order 50 of the Songs for Soldiers CDs for my son. He's graduating from high school, and I want to get one for each person in his class because he's going into Marine Corps. And I was so moved by that, because then I realized that that music not only spoke to me when I wrote it, it spoke to those young men and women that were serving. And I didn't want to make any money off of it, because this speaks to your question. The last thing I wanted to do was profit from it. So we decided, that's where the college fund idea came from. We decided, well, when we sell a CD, we'll just put it into a fund and then we'll give it back to them. And that was, you know, we actually have raised over $1.5 million and sent 123 people to college. And on top of that, that song that was on there, there's a song on there called Red, White, and Blue that got chosen to be played at all the memorial services in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so they've been playing it. And when they have the ceremony at the camp where the camp or the base where the young man or woman died, they would play this song. And so even though that song was never like a hit song or on the radio, if you meet a soldier, and I meet lots of them, they know that song. And that means so much to me that it would occupy such a place in their heart.
Just tremendous. Just tremendous. Okay. So the question I was going to ask after you first talked about having served in the Army was, and folks, stay with us, you're going to see how this all ties together. Rocky, getting back to having been abandoned at the Barium Springs Home for Children, you did at one point look to track down your biological family, and with that came some amazing discoveries, specifically having to do with your dad and your uncle.
Exactly. Well, the short part of my uncle is that I've been singing at the Vietnam Wall. I wrote the song Thank You, which is the theme song for the 50th commemorative. It's on that same record, the one we went over there and did. And I would sing at the Vietnam Wall every year on Veterans Day, and then we would do it again on Memorial Day after the motorcycle ride, the Rolling Thunder ride. And I found out that my uncle was killed in Vietnam, my biological uncle, and his name is on the wall. Even though it meant so much to sing to those men, if you could believe it, it even meant more knowing that my family was tied to that.
I'm sure.
But in the course of making this rounds, they hired a DNA company called 23andMe. It was a gift from my friend Kathleen to me for my birthday. And all of a sudden, a sister shows up. And I have three sisters, a brother, and a father.
Wow.
He's 84 years old, and he was still alive.
Wow.
And so he never knew that I was born. He never knew that he'd had another son. He had a whole family, but he didn't know that he had had this other child. And guess what he did, Bruce?
Musician.
He was a guitar player in a country band.
Oh, my gosh.
He was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne in the same unit that I was in.
Wow.
And he rode a motorcycle his whole
life. Oh, my gosh.
Within 10 minutes of meeting each other, he was skeptical, and we met at a restaurant, actually, a very public place for the first time, because he was skeptical about DNA and that sort of thing. But within 10 minutes, it was obvious that he was my father. And probably 20 minutes after I met him, I was sitting right beside him, and he reached across my lap, and he grabbed my wrist with his hand, and he squeezed it really hard, and he said, "I just want you to know that if I'd have known you were in that place, I'd have come and got you." And I never had anybody say anything like that to me before. And he meant it. I mean, he meant it with all of his heart. And so I got to spend 3 years with him alive and getting to know him. And I'd go up to his house and sit on the porch and play. I'd bring my fiddle player and my daughter and my sisters. And, you know, Thanksgiving at our house used to be a little table and a couple kids. And now Thanksgiving is at a big Baptist church in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, with cousins and nieces and nephews. And I'm like Elvis. I walk in, it's like, there's Uncle Rocky. And it's like, they just wrapped their arms around me. You know, it could have been different. You know, it could have not ended like that. But it ended up, in my situation, it ended up with a beautiful ending.
Oh,
and then
my
he
gosh.
Passed away during COVID. Mm. And, you know, it's interesting because he was a soldier. You know, he was a Korean War veteran. And he was on his last couple hours of his life, and I was sitting by his bed. Right by his bedside, he had a picture of me playing on the Grand Ole Opry, and they were playing my music on the speakers that were in the room. And I told him, I said, he hadn't spoken in a day or so, I guess, at that point. And I leaned into his ear, and I said, "Tomorrow is Tribute to the Troops Florida," because that's when the Tribute Florida ride was. And I said, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stay here and be with you." And he opened up his eyes, Bruce, and he looked right at me. He hadn't spoken in a day. And he said, "It's important, son. You go."
Oh, my gosh.
He passed away a couple hours later. And I went to Florida, and I rode my motorcycle, and we visited five families whose children had died. And I swear I could feel him on my shoulder. Man, I could feel him as I was going down that road.
I'm having trouble with this one. I'm sorry, folks. I'm just all kinds of choked up. This is, we could wrap up right now, and this would be such a powerful episode. Wow, I just have too many more questions that I want to get through with Rocky, but just tremendous. So just clarify, Rocky, before I move on. So when your sister said, you know, you've got these other siblings, our dad is alive, it's a, so you were living, I assume, in Statesville. And where was your dad when you met him for the first time? Where did he live?
Well, just to expound upon that a little bit, Bruce, their mother had passed away right before my sister Melinda put it on 23andMe.
Okay.
And right before she died, she said that you ought to look around and see that, because you might have some siblings out there. Her mother told that to her as she was passing away.
Wow.
And my biological father, Clyde, who is an extremely religious man now, and he passed away, but he called himself, this is the word he used, he said, "When I was younger, I was a rounder." He called himself a rounder. And I guess that means that he would be promiscuous, you know. And so that's why they joined the 23andMe, and that's how we found them. But he lived his whole life in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, which is about two towns over from where I live.
Oh.
And most people would play, you know, they work at fast food restaurants or something in high school. I played in a band. I played in a band with a bunch of old men, a bunch of people my age now.
Mm-hmm.
And we would play all the honky tonks around here, all the ones in Hickory and Winston-Salem and Wilkesboro. he was playing those same exact places too. It's weird that I don't think our paths ever crossed, but for sure I would be playing someplace that he had played the week before many times.
Just amazing. Just amazing. Oh, folks, in the intro, I promised you information on a brand new method of interaction with this show. So let me tell you about that as I reset first by saying that I am joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from north of Charlotte, North Carolina, by recording artist Rocky Lynn. Visit his official website at rockylynnwhereibelong.com. I will put a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Once you land on his website, tap or click into the store section. And then on there, you want to look for where it says CDs. His brand new album, just released less than 2 weeks ago, called Love, is available on there, including on vinyl. Plus, you will see his back catalog as well. There's plenty of other merchandise, too. We are about to discuss the brand new documentary that was also just released. You can see that now on Amazon Prime. At the top of RockyLynnWhereIBelong.com, there are links, logos, to get Rocky's music from Spotify, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. You will also see options there to go follow him on Facebook, Twitter, I know, X, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. As I mentioned in the intro, he has live shows coming up May 26th in Lady Lake, Florida, and June 14th in Huntersville, North Carolina. Keep up with Rocky online for details on where and when you can go see him perform live. Okay, now at the start of this show every week, I always invite you to email me or to DM me through the Now Hear This Entertainment Instagram account. There is a platform out there called Featured Up that is now a third way that you can engage with me in this show. There's no cost for this, by the way. I have put their logo on my podcast website, nhte.net, so that you can click over to my page on there. What this allows you to do is participate in post-episode Q&A with me, discussions, engagement, and potentially be featured in Best Questions on upcoming episodes of NHTE. Again, go to my show website, nhte.net, and look for the Featured Up logo, and then tap or click that to go to my page on their site and submit your questions. I will be looking forward to interacting with you through this new platform. And Rocky, I have one more question before we get into the documentary, and I don't know if people will see this when they watch it or not. So you have a really cool story I would love for you to tell about ending up in the office of the CEO of Universal Music Group. Can you share that story with the audience, including, of course, how that ended up going?
Yeah, well, I lived in Nashville for many, many years, and I was a sideman. I played with people who had record deals. I didn't know how they got them. I just knew that they had them. And I decided to go out on my own and see if I could do my own thing. And so back in those days, you probably remember this, Bruce, you could make a living playing in honky-tonks and nightclubs.
Yeah.
You go to the big ones, you know, you play a whole week, like at Grizzly Rose, then you go down to Billy Bob's or... Where do you live, Bruce?
I live in Tampa.
Oh, in Tampa. Well, out in Bradenton, there was a place called Joyland. It might still be there.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, and you play there for a week. Well, I was playing up in Minnesota, of all places, and I was playing at a place called Pavlitsky's, and they had a night off. We weren't playing on Wednesday because they were going to have boxing in there. And this Minnesota lady said to me, "Do you want to go see the best band in Minnesota?" That's how they talk up there. And I said, "Yes, I do." And so I went there, and nice people, nice. They had a good crowd, and this band was playing cover music, which is interesting because we didn't play cover songs. We just played, even back then, we just played my songs. And a guy come out singing. He had a nice voice. He was handsome, but he sounded like he was from Minnesota. They were doing old-timey country music. I think that they opened with Chattanooga, and he started singing, "Way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, you know." And I said, "Man, there ain't a person that talks like me within 500 miles of this place." So I decided to move to Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Wow.
After 15 years in Nashville. So I did. I moved to Minneapolis, wow, and I started over. And within a year and a half, Bruce, we had sold 150,000 records
out
of the trunk of the car. And I was doing exactly what that boy was doing. We were, the year before I got signed, I did 321 nighters. And that's without bus and crew and all that. It's just me and my blind piano player and two guys. Anyway, I was playing at a place called St. Patrick's Tavern down in the southern part of Minneapolis. And this lady was there who worked for Universal Records. Her name was Elise Levy. And she came up to me and said, "What the heck are you doing here? Why are you playing this place?" I said, "Because it's my gig. You know, this is what I do." And she got me an appointment in New York City with Kevin Law, who was a head of A&R at Universal then. And so they flew me and my budding young manager to New York City, and we stayed at the Hudson, which is about as big as a closet. With two beds in the closet. And I went and had a meeting with Kevin Law, and he said he had locked out, I think, 30 minutes for the meeting. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Sing me a song." And so I sang him a song, and he said, "Sing me another song." And he said, "Sing me another." And then he got on the phone and told the lady, Jen, his assistant, "Cancel my meeting for the rest of the day." And I sat there and sang this for that guy for probably sat there for 2 hours. And I probably sang 50 or 60 songs for him.
Wow.
And then he said, "I'm going to set you up to sing for Doug Morris in the morning. Can you stay one more day?" And I said, "Yes." And so the next morning, this kid from a dirt road in North Carolina went to the Universal Music building there in New York City and went to Monty Lipman's office, because Monty's office had a stage in it. And it was Monty Lipman, Avery Lipman, Tommy Mottola was there, Doug Morris. I mean, it was every big person ever been in the music business. Luckily, I didn't know who they were. I had no idea who they were. And they came in, and I sung that song more. I sung this song more, which I felt like might be my best song. Mm-hmm. And Doug Morris signed me right then and right there. Wow. And he moved. Listen to this, Bruce. They moved me from the Hudson, which is about the size of a closet, to the Plaza. They moved me to the Grand Plaza Hotel and put me in a suite overlooking the
Central Park.
The Central Park there. And, you know, I'm not bragging. I'm not really very ostentatious, but it was just quite the thing to be in that room. And and that day, I got a piece of wisdom that day that I'd like to pass on to your young people that are listening, that
please,
are playing.
Please.
Because when I got done, Doug Morris said to me, he said, "You ever get nervous when you sing?" And I said, "Every once in a while I do, you know." And he said, "Well, you just sang to all the biggest names in the music business. You should never be nervous again." And you know what? I haven't been. I just don't get nervous. I figure I'm not going to get any better or get any worse. So I just go up there and do the best I can, right?
Wow. Wow. What a story. What a story. So anyhow, and you can also mention whether that story you just told is included in it or not, but congratulations on the new documentary, which is titled Where I Belong. How long did that take? What gave you the idea in the first place to make a documentary? Who did you work with on it? How tough was it or wasn't it to get it on Amazon Prime? Give us all the details about making that project.
Well, I had been asked to host this show that was on A&E called Operation Build. They did remakes of soldiers' homes who had been injured so they could get up to their houses and stuff. And apparently the original host had left. Here's how this happened. This is just pure luck. The original host had left, and they were going to do this other soldier's home, and they needed a host right away. And he said, "Can you play this music when you do my show?" And he gave them a song for Soldier's Record, because I had played for him when he was in Iraq before he got injured. But he liked my music and wanted him to play it. Mm-hmm. So they called us. They called my manager and said, "Could we get a gratis license to use this song?" And we said, "Of course, you can have any of that music." And then I happened to be listening to the call, and I said, "Why don't I just come sing it?" And so I went and sang. When he did the reveal for the song, I was sitting in the living room, and I sung Heroes Come From Small Towns, because that was his favorite song. That's how it happened. But anyway, I didn't know it, but that was their host's last show. And so I noticed that they were all looking at me funny at the end of the day share, and they come up and said, "You wouldn't want to host the last two episodes of this show, would you?" And I said, "Yes, I would." And so I hosted a couple of them. And the main writer for that show was a lady named J.C. Summerford. And she's the one that really gets the credit for this, because she had an idea for a TV show. And then she heard my music, and she thought I did pretty good hosting that show. It was her idea to do a documentary. I thought it was a dumb idea. I mean, you know, my beginning being found, you know, being found and abandoned, that's not really a movie. That's just being dealt a really bad hand. You know, you got dealt a bad hand, and you have to just have, everybody gets bad hands. And then going in the Army really wasn't a movie. And then I'd written some songs that were a little bit successful. I didn't know that that was a movie. But then when she found my father and the things that we talked about with that, to me, and that time that I spent with him, just so, and then, and we won't give it away, but the story of my mother is even more amazing than the story of my father when you get into that. So J.C. Summerford had this idea to make this movie. And she's from Florida. She's from down around Boca Raton. And she moved up here and rented a B&B in Statesville. And it was a small team. And we started working on it. And then COVID happened.
Oh, boy.
And COVID kind of shut us down because, you know, they we couldn't interact with people, all that. And then halfway through COVID, my father passed away. And chronologically, here's what happened. We finished the movie, and then we took it on what they call the film festival circuit.
Yep.
And the film festival is where it's kind of like a fancy dog show, I think. Everybody comes and brings their film, and they play it. So, but and we didn't know what kind of response we were going to get, how it was going to go, nothing. And my biggest fear was that it would suck, that the movie would suck and people wouldn't like it. Because did I tell you about the first time I ever scored a movie, Bruce? Did
no,
I tell you that?
No.
So I have this little studio, and, and my standard response to people when they ask me a question is like, can you score a film or can you make a song? I always say, yeah, I can do that, even if I can't do it. I say I can do it, and I'll try to figure it out. So someone had called me several years ago, this has been 15, 20 years ago, and said, could you score a film? Because they wanted to use one of my songs in the movie. And I said, could you score the whole thing? And I said, yes. And so I did. And I worked on the music, and they were going to have the debut of this movie in Asheville, North Carolina, because that's where the doctor that the film was made about. It wasn't a documentary. It was an actual acting film. And so I went to the debut and never seen the movie. And it was horrible. It was like the worst movie I've ever seen in my whole life. But it was well thought. It was good-hearted try. You know, they made a good try. My music was in it. And my thought was I didn't want my documentary to be that. I wanted it to be better if it could. But anyway, we ended up winning. Every time you do good at a film festival, they give you these little things that look like leaves of laurels. And
yeah,
they go
I saw there's seven of them. I counted on your on the homepage of your website. I saw them all.
Yeah, we got seven, but we ended up winning like 17 of them.
Wow.
And then the seven of them were kind of famous film festivals.
Wow.
So I think they put those on there. And that I think that helped Amazon.
Okay.
And then it's coming out on PBS as well. So I think they're doing a pretty good job getting it out there.
So was that story that you told before we got into the documentary, was that story you told about Universal Music Group, is that shown in the documentary?
No, I don't think it is. Here's the one, the first time she did a edit for the movie, the film edit, after we had cut it and everything, she had it cut down to 4 hours and 28 minutes or something like that of what she felt like needed to be in the movie. Because, I mean, I'm not 20 years old. You know, I'm 142 years old or however old. So I've got quite the long life. And then for it to get on PBS, which was the first people that were interested, they needed that movie to be 56 minutes long instead of 4 hours and 40 minutes long, or however long it was. So we cut. It got to the point JC was weeping at some point. She was like, I can't cut another thing. But I think what happened at this edit, I think, it, you know, because now the movie that's on Amazon is 56 minutes long. And I think it goes pretty good. The pace is fast and it moves quickly and it gets you through it, you know. And so I think that we've mentioned that I got signed to Universal, obviously, and that I think they have a picture of Doug Morris and me in the movie.
Okay.
But we just kind of go over it really fast because they had somewhere else they wanted to go, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. But audience, you know, one huge lesson, especially those of you that are young, aspiring performers, one huge lesson that I hope you're pulling out of this, even though it's not directly being said, is the tremendous humility that Rocky has displayed throughout this whole conversation. To be someone that has just released a documentary and say, I got abandoned. I didn't think that was a movie, and I did this, and I didn't think that was a movie, and I did this, and I didn't think that was a movie. It's real easy to give in to ego, and it's real easy to say, somebody should make a movie about me, or I should make a movie. I mean, myself, I've been through two open-heart surgeries. I've had two strokes. I was in a motorcycle accident. I had COVID that put me in the hospital for a week. My heart history still continues to this day, but I don't think I'm anybody that should have a documentary made about me. And yet, you know, Rocky's also put himself in the right place at the right time. Listen to the story that he told about, hey, do you want to host the last couple of episodes? So, you know, you do have to kind of put yourself out there, but put yourself out there and leave the ego behind, and the good things will come to you. The good things will find you. I will get off my soapbox, but I'm also Rocky at the same time, tipping my cap to you because I love the humility that you've displayed throughout our conversation. So in a number of places online, you are referred to as a guitar virtuoso. If I asked you to put in order what you consider yourself to be first, second, and third out of singer, songwriter, and guitar player, is it safe to assume that you would say guitar player first? And by the way, who have been some of your guitar heroes over the course of your career?
Well, Bruce, that's great advice you were given a minute ago. I want to applaud you for saying those things to those young people that are listening.
Thank you.
The one thing about the movie that has most surprised me more than anything else is that somehow or another, some people watch the movie and get the idea that I think I know what I'm doing on the guitar. Well, I do not. I look at guitar exactly the way I look at a motorcycle. And I think you might agree with this, being a motorcyclist yourself. The day that you think you know how to ride that motorcycle, you need to hang those keys up.
Yep, that's right.
Because you have to be vigilant.
That's right.
And you have to always wear your safety gear, always realize that it's a blessing to be on it, but it's also dangerous. And it's, I feel the same way about guitar. I was 4 years old when this man came to the orphanage, and he sang, "I'm going to Alabama with a banjo on my knee." I remember it like it was yesterday. Mm. And I fell in love with the guitar. I said to myself then, I said, I'm going to try to learn to play that thing for the rest of my life. I knew it immediately what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Wow. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how I would ever get one. Mm-hmm. But then when I was adopted, my mom and dad, I told you they're wonderful, loving, good people. But my mom had a third grade education, and my dad had finished the fifth grade. Mm. And they grew up during the Depression. It was hard. My dad actually, his father was an alcoholic. That's probably why nobody in this house ever drank. Mm. But he was hit by a car and paralyzed when my dad was in the fifth grade.
Wow.
So my dad had to quit school. My adopted dad's who I'm talking about, had to quit school and go to work in a sawmill to support his 10 brothers and sisters, and I guess his father too. So, and then when they got married, they weren't able to have children, but it was harder for them to adopt because of their financial situation. But the older kids, because I was older, like babies get adopted right away, and I didn't get adopted because this is probably too much information for your listeners, but because they didn't turn me over in the orphanage and the back of my head was flat. So it was misshapen. And that's what the lady said the first day. She said, "You don't want him. He's got a flat head. They forgot to turn him over." That's what she said.
Oh, gosh.
But anyway, I always wanted to play guitar for my whole life. And I don't think of myself as a singer at all. I started singing because singers were so flaky and they wouldn't show up and I wanted to play. So I just started singing. I think I might be an okay communicator in that, you know, some of the greatest people who have been songwriters like Bob Dylan and John Prine and Tom Petty and Burt Bacharach, for that matter, weren't really great singers. They were great communicators. Mm. They were people who could tell you a story and move you with it. And I might have a little bit of that gift, but as far as like natural musical talent, I don't have any natural musical talent. I have an insatiable desire to learn, and I have a work ethic that has got me on the phone with Bruce, got me here with you. But I play in a band with a bunch of naturally gifted musicians. So I guess to rate what I do first, second, and third is I'm just trying to learn how to play guitar and trying to give it everything I have. That's kind of where I am with it. As far as guitar players I love, the first music I was ever exposed to, we didn't have a TV in the house here until I was in high school growing up. But my mom took me to the first Baptist church yard sale in Statesville, North Carolina, and they had a phonograph and two albums. Now, this is at a Baptist church, so you know they didn't look in that phonograph to see what these records were, because the two records were Kiss Alive and Jimi Hendrix, Axis Bold as Love.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, if you couldn't have a better example than Ace Frehley and Jimi Hendrix to start your music world with, I mean, is that the best ever?
That's right.
Yeah. And I just fell in love with the sounds that were coming out of the guitar. And when I was in between sixth and seventh grade, I mowed yards all summer with this guy named John Baker here in town and bought a guitar from JCPenney's for $100. And that was my first guitar. I still have it.
Mm.
And then by high school, I was really into like Rush and Genesis. And for country players, for me, it was always like Merle Travis and Don Rich and those kind of players like that. And then as I got into GIT, I started really liking jazz players. And I love Robin Ford, and I love Wes Montgomery, and I like B.B. King. I like all kinds of guitars and guitar players. I guess one of my favorite guitar players that doesn't get as much recognition as I think he should is a guy named Richie Kotzen. He was in the band Poison for a minute, but he's got this bluesy voice, and he just plays the devil out of the guitar, and I love his playing too, so I just wanted to mention him as far as like people I look up to. Steve Morris is one of my favorite guitar players, Jimmy Herring.
Well, and you had already won me over long ago, but audience, those of you that have been with me a long time, yes, I heard him say Rush. Thank you. You know, we've acknowledged way, way, way too many times on this show that that's my all-time favorite band. So I was always hoping that you would say Alex Lifeson, and there you go. You've got it there. Audience, don't overlook the fact that Rocky mentioned that I already said that his documentary is on Amazon Prime. Don't overlook the fact that Rocky said that starting in September, the documentary is going to be available on PBS stations, but it's also going to be streamable on the PBS app. So that's going to be a nice platform to have it available through as well. Back in the intro, I read off some really, really impressive performances, Rocky, that you have gotten to do over the years on Good Morning America, Fox News, CMT, more than a dozen appearances on the Grand Ole Opry. Can I put you on the spot and ask you to pick one highlight from all those and tell us that story? Unless there's a different performance that you've done that's not in that list that you would rather tell us about instead.
Well, Bruce, I'm humbled that anybody would come and sit down in a chair and want to hear a song that I've written or hear me sing. And so every one of those gigs is an honor and a privilege. And I guess if I had to think about the gig that I like the most, once a year, we do it when we do Rolling Thunder, I go to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and we play in the lunchroom where they bring, you know, all the wounded soldiers that can, that are mobile, they all come in there. And my charity brings backpacks. And in the backpacks, we have like soap and just toiletries, things that will help them get through the, you know, to help them go. And then after the performance there, they always let me go room to room. And I'll go into a room. It'll be just me and a boy that was injured in a truck accident in Germany, or his legs got shot off in Iraq, and singing one-on-one to somebody like that, and then having God give me the songs, like some of the songs on those songs for Soldiers speaks to those men. That's to me has been some of the most emotional times I've ever played, or standing in those yards with those families and singing those songs. I think the tribute events and the going overseas, I think those mean a lot more to me than maybe the great big places.
I get it. I can totally see that. I should not be surprised for you to come out with that answer, because I totally understand it, and you've done such a good job of painting a picture where I think, audience, you can clearly see it as well. We're going to close today with a song that is actually the last track on Rocky's new album, one called My Father's Guitar. Rocky, before I let you go and I play that song, share with the audience first all about this one, if you would, please.
Well, one of the things that my biological father surprised me with in my life is, as he was getting near the end of his, he had his wife go into the closet and get the guitar that he played. When you go see Clyde Holloway play in North Carolina, he'd always be playing this same guitar. It's a 1978 Martin D35. And he loves his children, his three daughters and his son, and I know how much he loves them. But he wanted me to have that guitar. He said, I want you to take this guitar. And I'm honored to have it. And I sat down with it, and I remembered that thing that he said. You know, you see, when he told it, I called himself a rounder.
Yeah.
And that verse came out first. It says, he called himself a rounder all his life. Made a few mistakes, saw the light. You know, and then that's the forgiveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this song, My Father's Guitar, was the first song that I wrote on the guitar that my father actually gave me.
Wow. A great way to end the interview, a great way to end the album. As I said, that's the last track on there. Rocky, so wonderful to meet you. Congratulations on the new album. Congratulations on the documentary. And thank you so much for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Thanks for helping me with this project, Bruce. I really appreciate it.
God bless you, my friend. I'm happy to do it for you. With that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to singer, songwriter, guitar player Rocky Lynn. Do visit his official website at rockylynnwhereibelong.com. Again, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. You heard about his new album called Love. As I mentioned earlier, when you land on his website, go into the store section and you will see it available there, including an option to get it on vinyl. Plus, there's lots of other original music as well from his back catalog. Be sure to check out the other merchandise options throughout his online store, too. For those who prefer online digital music retailers, look at the top of rockylynnwhereibelong.com for links to Apple Music, Spotify, and Amazon Music. You will also see social media options to follow Rocky on numerous platforms. This morning, I followed him on Facebook, X, and Instagram, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same. He is also on TikTok and YouTube. In fact, he has a combined total of over 860,000 video views on his official YouTube channel. May 26th, he will be performing live in Lady Lake, Florida, and June 14th, he will be doing a show in Huntersville, North Carolina. Keep up with Rocky online for details on where and when you can go see him perform live. And obviously, as we talked about, Amazon Prime for the documentary, and then it's going to be coming to PBS and their app in September. I do truly hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with Rocky and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, more than 10 years without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 534. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with another song from Rocky Lynn. This is the one he just talked about. It's called My Father's Guitar.
My father's guitar laid silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer played the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it from me. Back when he was younger on the road, he took it everywhere, or so I'm told. Honky-tonks and bars, out among the stars, there never was a song he didn't know. My father's guitar laid silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer played the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it from me. I remember how it felt when he told me he'd always dreamed of Nashville, Tennessee, writing country songs. I knew it all along. We shared more than just our family tree. My father's guitar laid silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer play the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it from me. Himself a rounder all his life. He made a few mistakes but saw the light. As the story goes, and a few of you may know, I'm one of his mistakes that he made right. My father's guitar lay silent in the closet of his home in Miller's Creek. His hands no longer play the way they used to. I guess he was keeping it from me. My father's guitar laid silent. I guess he was keeping it.